You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
This week's bits. The best news nuggets from Breakfast and The Wire from this week.
Atamadie, Kohana Ross Tokuingua, and welcome to this week's bits. Last week, a chemical attack on a rebel-held Syrian town killed at least 58 people, including 11 children. The United Nations have said they would be investigating it as a possible war crime. Following the chemical attack, the United States then launched a military strike on a Syrian government airbase. The strike was the first direct military action taken by the US against the regime of a Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, in the country's six-year civil war. First, let's look at an interview with Green Party co-leader Mintidia Ture about the airstrike in Syria.
We don't condone at all the airstrikes by the US. You don't protect people's lives by killing more people. It was a completely inappropriate act by the US, and contrary to the current negotiations that are going on there to try to resolve the conflict, but also potentially in conflict with international law. So, it's kind of classic reactive Trump decision-making with very little thought to what the impact of it will be on the rest, on what's going on in Syria. And I think it's been really damaging, actually.
And the comment has been made that this was kind of Trump's first action that's really made him president. What are your thoughts on that kind of statement?
Well, I agree with the criticism that, you know, if going to war is presidential, then it makes the whole concept of being presidential quite a dirty one. I mean, that is not what the definition or criteria for presidential act should be. Killing people is not presidential, in my view. It is a disgraceful thing to do. So there's been a lot of criticism of the act, and I think that that's right. And I think that that will continue. The issue, the other part of the issue, is that this strike by the US is not going to solve the problem. It's not going to make any difference to the Assad regime. It's not going to help with any of the international negotiations that are going on. It makes no difference at all. It just makes Trump feel better. And that is there are reports of civilians having been killed by those missiles. You know, if Trump feels better because more people have died, I think that's pretty gross.
And obviously this has escalated tensions between the US and Syria and then Russia. I know Trump forewarned Putin about these strikes, and China's involved too. How does Aotearoa fit into these kind of international politics that are going on?
Well, loosely at the moment. I mean, I know that Bill English has not ruled out responding to a US request for assistance. I mean, we would be absolutely opposed to New Zealand being involved in such a thing. The big issue between the US and Russia, by all accounts, this will not have a huge impact on what is an increasingly close relationship between the US and Russia. I mean, there are bigger political issues being played out through this conflict. To a large extent, it's a proxy war, and there are many other interests involved in the Middle East. The fact is, though, that killing more people is not the solution.
And that was Mintidia Ture with Amanda Jane Robinson. The war in Syria is in its sixth year, and as a war has been plagued by the spread of propaganda, misinformation and competing narratives, as the parties involved attempt to control the information war taking place alongside the conflict on the ground. However, how exactly does the media cover this conflict? What barriers do they face? And who should we believe when there are so many different versions of the events? Reporter Sam Smith spoke to University Auckland political studies lecturer Maria Amodoyan about the role of the media during war and conflict.
I think the role of media in conflict, but also outside of conflict, is generally that we've got to give people information about what is going on so that people understand what is happening in their names by their governments or by other groups. People need to know a lot of things. For one, are there atrocities being committed under their names. Or, and another thing is, of course, are certain regions unsafe to travel to? So there are a whole host of things that people need to know, and this is particularly true in democracy more than anything else, because people get to say whether or not they want to keep their leaders in office. How are they spending their money? Are they spending them on ethical, good, moral, sound judgment, humanitarian aid, or are they spending their money on things that generally we would not approve of? So this is just kind of a general idea of a journalist's role. It's particularly difficult in conflict, and that's because, as one award-winning journalist who went on to become a journalism professor in Los Angeles, Michael Parks, has often said, the guys with the guns make the rules, and journalists have to follow the rules in which they must report under. And so that means there are certain constraints. Doesn't mean they follow them completely to the T, but it means that there are constraints that make it very difficult for journalists to get into conflict zones or other types of areas in order to get that information to the public.
How much influence then do the parties involved in conflict have in controlling the narrative and what gets told?
Well, it's a little bit of a sort of a struggle between journalists and the parties of the conflict. So journalists want to find out what's happening. A good journalist, a good ethical, responsible journalist, wants to get to the truth of the matter, the heart of the matter, what's really going on here. And so when you think about what they have to go through, which is often quite, you know, difficult and complicated, but a lot of times they have to get pre-screened, sometimes they get censored, sometimes they get punished, and these are all things that they consider before they enter a conflict zone. Often they have to have some kind of pass to get into a conflict zone too. Well, who do you think gives those passes? Sometimes it's a government, right? And so you may not even be able to get in if the government doesn't want you in. But sometimes it's a rebel group. So there were cases, for example, I interviewed a bunch of journalists for my past book, some cases where journalists were having to get passes from these rebel groups, much like ISIS. And so in order to get through, you have to be able to make a case. Well, what is that case that you're making? What's the story you're going to tell? And are you going to be able to survive to tell that story? Of course, there's a third way that people get into conflict zones, the third primary way, and that's by embedding with the military. And that's sometimes a government military, but sometimes it's a rebel military. And in both of those cases, you see essentially what the rebel group or the government military is seeing. You don't necessarily see what's outside of that. They are protecting you. Journalists are now protected by those military forces, and so there is a relationship that builds that might start to color the reporting that comes out. One more thing, the final way that sometimes journalists do go into these zones is by sneaking in, getting smuggled in, bribing their way in, fake IDs, and some actually do this and come out with really important stories.
Why is it then that so much misinformation and propaganda gets spread during conflicts?
Because it's very hard to cover. I mean, first of all, you're asking a journalist to risk his or her life to go into a conflict zone like Syria. And, you know, you've seen that how many journalists have been killed in Syria. I haven't looked at the latest numbers, but they're really big numbers. And some of these journalists who are, you know, tried and true, have covered conflict after conflict after conflict, know their stuff, know how to travel, know how to report this material, and are still getting killed. So Marie Colvin is one of these examples. She had been reporting on conflict for a very long time. She'd been injured before. She went to Syria. She was staying in a particular area where a lot of journalists were staying, and the Syrian government shelled it. And so she's dead. And this, you know, so this is one reason why propaganda is such an easy thing to do, because you don't have third parties able to go in there, cover the material, and come out with uncensored, unpunished information.
And that was Maria with Sam Smith. Then, on Dear Science this week, we talked to Alan Blackman about the history behind the uses of chemical weapons in light of the recent Syria chemical attack.
Of course, the horrendous events in Syria of last week sort of prompted me to have a talk about this. And being a chemist, obviously, I'd like to think I know a little bit about chemical weapons. So they started probably further or longer ago than a lot of people think. So you can trace them back to around 9th century China, the first chemical weapons. And they then sort of migrated along the Silk Road, and they ended up in Europe in around about the 14th century. So what we would recognisably call today chemical weapons. So that's, you know, that's a good sort of 600, 700 years of Western use of these chemical weapons. And it basically revolutionised warfare, because obviously now you've got the ability to not have to engage in sort of hand-to-hand fighting, that you can sort of lob projectiles at your enemy, and these projectiles will destroy your enemies. So, and it all goes back to, as I say, 9th century China, and in particular a chemical called potassium nitrate, otherwise known as saltpeter. And that there were huge deposits of this in China, and the Chinese found out if you mix this with particular other chemicals, then you've got your chemical weapons. And in terms of these chemical weapons, they rely on a particular chemical reaction that's called oxidation. And what that does is essentially it turns a solid into a gas very, very, very rapidly, and allows you to, again, as I say, hurl projectiles at your enemies. So so the name of that chemical weapon that the Chinese came up with was a thing called gunpowder. And perhaps people might be a bit surprised by that, because you wouldn't classify gunpowder as being a chemical weapon. But it is. Anything where you're shooting a projectile at somebody else is a chemical weapon. It's all based on chemistry, okay?
Right. And I'd never kind of thought about it in that sort of way.
Yeah, and not a lot of people have, okay? So you're relying on chemistry to shoot somebody.
Right, and relying on that that reaction,
yes,
to
absolutely
happen,
yep,
to as a weapon.
And that's how all guns, mortars, howitzers, whatever, work, okay, on the basis of that. Now, people generally sort of date first chemical weapons to the First World War, when they were first used by the Germans and then retaliated by the English. But I guess my point is that this civil war has been going on in Syria for, oh my goodness, how many, 7 years now, there or thereabouts? And we've had one side or the other side of Weber bombing civilian neighbourhoods with so-called conventional weapons, and there's a little bit of outrage expressed, but nothing gets done. But as soon as you put a little sarin gas in one of those projectiles and drop it on a civilian neighbourhood, then for some reason the world gets on its moral high horse and threatens war, basically, because of the fact that they've got this little bit of so-called chemical weapon in it. Who feels more pain? Somebody who's been sort of had shrapnel go through them, or somebody who's inhaled a chemical weapon? What's the difference? They're both going to end up dead.
Is that because the sarin gas attack had a bigger effect, though? Is it because it killed more people instead of...
Not necessarily. I mean, you know, you just drop bombs on civilian neighbourhoods. I mean, look at Mosul at the moment. They're fighting for that. And, you know, there's this terrible civilian casualties there. And, you know, that's not chemical weapons. And Mosul's a great example, because 6 or so months ago at least, we were promised that the Iraqi army were just going to overrun the place, and, you know, and ISIS were going to be kicked out of there. And then all of a sudden everything went suspiciously quiet in the media, and you never heard about Mosul until maybe a month or so ago. And you know, it's hand-to-hand fighting and everything. No chemical weapons there. People are just dying because of grenades and bombs and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I don't see any difference personally. We should be equally outraged at this.
So why do you think there is this distinction in the way that it's treated by world leaders and the media?
It's a really good question. Really. I just think, you know, I hate to say it, but I think last week there was a bit of faux outrage. I think we need to be outraged by any civilian deaths, by any use of any weapons at all. Okay, so call me naive or whatever, but you know, these weapons are chemical weapons. All weapons are chemical weapons, basically. So let's not distinguish between them. Let's not be raised to action by these so-called chemical weapons, these sarin gases and everything. Let's be raised to action as soon as the first shot's fired.
That was this week's Bits. To listen to the full interviews, visit 95bfm.com and check out the BCasts.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/BCasts.